This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Will Downey from Austrade. How are you, Will?
That's me. I'm very well, thanks, Chris. Thanks for taking the time to catch up.
I hear a bit of an Aussie twang there, so I presume you're Australian.
Well, I'm going to compliment your twang, right? Maybe, maybe not.
No, I've been in England now for, 24 years, and so I think of myself as my accent as an international man of mystery.
If that makes you feel good. Yeah, no, I've been here for 18 years, so originally from Melbourne, Victoria.
Okay, cool. What we're going to do today is I want to talk about Austrade and a little bit about how Australia markets and sells their wines abroad.
Sure.
You're the senior business manager here in London, and you deal with London and Ireland.
Yeah, UK and Ireland is my remit. So Austrade's the Australian Federal Government Trade and Investment Agency. So I work in the trade side as opposed to the investment. And we support Australian businesses that are looking to grow through realising their export ambitions. So we have an onshore team in Austrade that will do a sort of a filtering onboarding process with a client. And once that client and Austrade sort of agree on a market, that client will be passed over to me. And I specialise in agribusiness, so food and drink, of which in this market, you know, it's red meat and wine are the sort of the two largest sectors outside of sort of pulses and sugar and so on in bulk. And also, you know, fun categories like seafood, packaged food, so premium honey, etc. But at the end of the day, wine is, you know, ubiquitous here in the UK, 20-year history, and it's a joy to support Australian wine clients into this market.
Is Austrade the only body that Australia uses? Because you see a lot of countries, they'll actually just hire a PR agency to represent them in a market.
Yeah.
But you guys have got your own team here.
Yeah, we've got an element of that. I mean, also there are state governments here, Australian state governments. So we have, you know, New South Wales, Queensland, WA, for example, doing sort of similar roles where they support clients from those particular states. You can also go through a third-party consultancy / agent type of business to support your launch. Mm-hmm. And I guess separate to that, we also have, you know, Wine Australia and MLA for meat and livestock, who offer sort of supporting roles, not exactly the same as we do. At the end of the day, we can offer clients assistance around sort of business planning, regulatory requirements for the UK, but we also help identify the key channels and customers that they want to launch in. So that could be retail, food service, or food manufacturing. And then we dive in those sort of targeted channels. So whether it's retail and they'd want to target the sort of off-trade or on-trade, and we support business matching at the end of the day. When it's all sort of the bells and whistles are stripped away, ultimately it comes down to business matching. That client wants to launch into the UK. They might need some assistance with import or distributor, but then how do I connect with Tesco or Mitchells and Butler's, the pub chain, or whatever it might be. So we assist around that.
So you guys have fingers or connections to a lot of UK businesses. Is that really what it's about?
Or? Yeah. So I guess the role that we have, where we're based in London or in a different market, is called Post. So I'm at Post here, and my background is into that food and drink market with those networks. So I bring the experience of years at Nestle and Heinz, and you know those networks and how the market works, and I sort of assist guide the client into the successful position.
Okay. Can you give us an example of a wine brand that you've helped, and just give me an idea of how it works? Because it does sound quite different to, say, maybe some of the French regionals that have representation in London or the UK.
Yeah. Yeah, look, generally we work with, on the whole, sort of the smaller, medium enterprises around wine. We deal with the treasuries and the accolades of this world for sure, but also we might get someone, and there's a couple of examples. So Ricky Ponting, ex-Australian cricket captain, mm-hmm. is a major stakeholder in his wine brand, Ponting Wines, and they don't have any representation in this marketplace. Met with Ricky and his business partners, understand how they go about it. They're aligned with Ben Riggs, who's who's a very well-known winemaker in Australia, and they were looking for support and connections into this market. So literally I was taking samples, conducting tastings with wine buyers at the likes of Ocado and Waitrose, and into also the wine distributor importer market like HN Wines, Laithwaite's, for example, and I'd try and connect them up and make the magic happen. And we did actually succeed in getting a listing in Ocado, for example. So that's sort of one example of where we offer support. If a brand is more established in the marketplace, then we can offer wine tastings, or we also have a number of events that we run throughout the year where we showcase Australian food and drinkers in total across the, it's almost like Australia Inc.
Yep.
And we will feature Australian wines in those events. And it could be here in Australia House, for example, where we want to celebrate the free trade agreement coming into force and the various anniversaries. And what we'll do is we'll have Australian Wagyu on the menu, we'll have Australian lamb, have seafood, but also we'll link in with the Australian wine offer. And that sort of reinforces the quality cues of Australian wine and its diversity and strength and consistency and, you know, delicious.
And do they pay you guys? Is it like commission based or anything? No, it's all.
No. Well, up until recently, it was a free support, and that went back to, in fact, COVID around that time. So a couple of things that happened. Obviously, COVID impacted, but also in 2019, there were massive fires on the east coast of Australia. And the combination of those two impacted particularly on sort of small, medium businesses, and the government at that time released funding, and we had an initiative called ABI, which is Agribusiness Expansion Initiative, and that was funding that went around the world to support Australian food and drink. That's where I joined the business at that time, and it was a free service then. We've only recently brought in a cost recovery model where we do charge our clients for a service, and that can be a multi-regional service across US, Asia Pacific here if they're that size, or a very regional sort of targeted approach.
Okay. And is this model used in all countries? Is this the way Australia promotes its wine around the world?
More broadly, that's how we go about it. So not just wine, but Australian food and drink. So
yeah, we're a wine show, though. So.
Yeah, let's stick with the wine. Yeah, no, that's how we go about it internationally.
Do you know other countries that follow a similar model?
As far as I'm aware, I think it's pretty stock standard from a government perspective. So you have those trade support systems in place around the world, and from time to time they move to a free of charge model, or they bring back in, you know, a cost recovery element. But I think that's pretty stock standard across government, from my experience.
Okay, yeah, I suppose a lot of the bigger players that I've spoken to, they tend to do a lot of their own work themselves, or they're already in the market. So.
Yeah, that's right. And as mentioned, you know, the larger clients across the piece will generally be able to support a resource in the market once they get established, and that's great. That's the ideal at the end of the day, if you can do that. But for these medium, smaller enterprises, we play a really important role in getting them established, and that can be finding them an importer distributor partner who's the right fit with a background in or a strength in the sector that they want to play. You know, that allows them to get established, and then generally the importer distributor will manage their business here in the UK.
You mentioned trade tastings. One of the things that Australia and New Zealand did a wee while ago is actually combined their trade tasting. You used to get New Zealand trade tasting, you used to get Australia trade tasting for the wine industry, and then they combined the two. Is that something that's going to continue on in the future, assuming both sides are happy with it?
Yeah, look, that's more of a Wine Australia initiative that was in the recent Australian trade tasting that happened in January. My understanding, I think this year was the first year that they tried that here in London at least, and then they did Edinburgh and Dublin, and it seemed to be a roaring success. So I think by combining the two wine regions with such sort of great reputations, but also complementary, Sauvignon Blanc out of NZ with everything else that Australia does, which is obviously higher standard than New Zealand. You know, it works out brilliantly. And they were, the events were, they got great crowds. So I think there's something in, you know, where we're, you know, Australia are looking to take on, the French, and that's a super competitive market where you can combine those two regions that offer something special and unique. I think it can work.
You talked about how you had the fires and then the Australian government stepped in with some funding to help, and
yep.
that's how you've been able to help it. Not just COVID, but after COVID, we had the big Chinese tariffs, and that really hammered your main export market. It really it collapsed it.
Yeah.
What has happened? The tariffs have gone.
Yeah.
And I've noticed in the news that Australia is going back into China.
Yes.
Are they going to be pushing to be number one export market again, or are they sort of once bitten, twice shy type of approach?
Well, no, the uptake's been really, really positive. Mm. So China is now the number one wine market for Australian wine. So it's again, recovered quite quickly. So the top three are China, UK and the US.
Yep.
So UK and US sort of move quarter by quarter in terms of volume. But I think it's probably indicative of the fact that the Chinese consumer seems to understand and appreciate Australian wine. So, you know, I guess that's a good thing. But where we also play a pivotal role is trade diversification. So the learning from that experience, you know, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, when there were the issues with China, it became pretty obvious that exporters needed to, I guess, spread the risk and, you know, not rely on eggs in one basket. And that's where the UK market, particularly on the back of the free trade agreement, which came into force 2 years ago now, has become increasingly more important. You know, we have seen sales generally grow across those bigger categories that I was mentioning. I won't talk about meat, but, you know, wine. And I think, you know, this region is really, 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 really important in mitigating that sort of longer term reliance, over-reliance on China. And that's one of our key strategies that we push, which is trade diversification. It's an Australian federal government strategy. You know, as someone who's passionate about both Australia and UK, I'll support that to the hilt.
There's been an international shift away from red wines to white wines. And there's a lot of people talking about low alcohol wine, no alcohol wine. Australia is known for big, gutsy red wines.
It's true.
So you're sort of batting the old product. Do you know what's going on in terms of maybe moving the needle a little bit so that it's more white than red perhaps, or working those alcohol levels down a little bit? Because, you know, I love a big gutsy red, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm unique. Well, not unique, but the trend.
Not at all. You're part of the existing sort of cohort that loves that, loves their wine. What we're seeing are sort of a number of challenges. So millennials, Gen Zs, drinking less full-bodied alcohol, in some instances alcohol at all. So that's creating a challenge. And then the other point that you mentioned was around the red and the white. And that also ties into environment in some cases. And what we've seen in Australia is a move away to more sort of innovative wine varietals like Fiano, for example, sort of out of, you know, Sicily or Italy there where it is drier and hotter. So we're seeing Australian winemakers becoming more experimental and taking those type of grape varietals in. And we are seeing a lot of no-low wines come through. One example would be Fourth Wave Wine, who do Little Giant and Elephant in the Room. They've got a really remarkable range of no or lower alcohols plus minus. So they're really catering to that trend. It's not just, I suppose, younger. You know, we're all more conscious of our health and the, you know, anxiety and so on, and they're doing it very well. So they approach the market in a really clever way. They understand or dive into the category here and identify gaps, and that can be, you know, into a younger profile, and they'll develop a label to encourage that initial interest. That I guess you're reaching the hand out to understand what that wine is. And they'll do blends at a lower alcohol content all the way through to zero. And they're also very switched on to things like conservation. So they've got a really strong reforestation program, for example, with their Tread Softly Pinot Noir, the number one Pinot Noir in Australia. Australia. And that's another example of where I think Australian wine is evolving. And we are seeing more Pinot Noir come into the marketplace. It's a much sort of lighter wine, which I think plays to that movement away from the bigger, bolder Shirazes and Cab Savs, which I also have to admit I love. But, I've not drunk so much, not that I drink a lot of wine, but Pinot Noir in the last, couple of years on the back of what we're seeing into the UK. So it's a really interesting movement.
Problem that creates, though, is that if you think about the big bulk regions in Australia, Riverlands, Riverina, that whole Murray-Darling irrigated area, that's really for high-volume, entry-level style of wines that tend to be very ripe, and red grapes do very well in that type of climate. So are you seeing any grubbing up or movement away from those areas? I know everybody keeps talking about moving to the cooler coastal areas in Australia and the premiumisation, but there's a lot of volume there. You look at every southeastern Australian wine, most of it comes from that area.
Yeah, and look, South Australia is probably the key example around that because it delivers 60% of the overall wine volume out of Australia. And we're not seeing any real movement away from any of that I've seen so far. I think a lot of it comes down to provided that the quality of the fluid, the liquid is there, there's still a level of interest. I guess a further example is, we're seeing sort of interesting blends with Shiraz and Viognier as well, which we tried yesterday just through sheer coincidence, where you're getting a sort of a slightly lighter effect by combining the blends. So I think the Australian wine market, wine makers are really working hard to innovate.
Okay, what do you think is going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years? You guys must have at least a little bit of a pulse on what's going on.
I think whether it's a long-term trend or a shorter-term trend around this healthier element, I think that's going to become more prevalent. And I think we can play a really leading role in that. I think we're more flexible than, say, the French and older established markets who would, curl their toes up. The Bordeaux region, I think, would curl their toes up if they ever had to do a no-low. I know they're discussing even a white varietal, and that's causing all sorts of mayhem. So I think where we can play a role is in that constant evolving and evolution and coming up with new varietals that play onto the trend of no low, but also over time. I think what I would guess is you'd probably see the younger drinker move it back into the worlds of the Cab Sav over time as their palates evolve. That would be my take on it. So I think we've got a really relevant role to play here as we start to tweak and see these trends become real behaviours rather than just hype that comes and goes.
Certainly sweet rosés are like the gateway drug for the younger generations, and then they move into whites, and then historically people move into reds. But you've got a big cohort of older drinkers who are sort of more traditional, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, and I think we'll still be able to service that. But you're absolutely right. Like, look at the way that the rosé section in wine, in particular, and I guess in off trade, has really grown. It's become a much more, I think, acceptable drink. It's not just a sort of sour or very rich drink anymore. There's real quality and real variety in what you can get.
All right then, Will. I think we'll wrap it up there.
My pleasure.
Cheers very much.